are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is...
Abe, hello! How are you, Aaron?
I'm doing well. It's a bit of a rainy Thursday, but I'm managing and staying warm. How are you doing?
I am also in a rainy area, I suppose. The winds have been quite strong out of the west. Back to you, sports.
Out Now is a film podcast where normally Abe and I discuss new movies weekly. However, every now and then, I think we like to have these special bonus episodes, whether it's one of our fun commentary tracks or something completely different. And this is something a little different because we normally in the winter, we talk about the Sundance Film Festival, which we did.
Yes.
But this year, I also attended the Santa Barbara International Film Festival for the first time.
Yeah.
I spent about 6 days out there up in Santa Barbara.
A long time.
It's a good amount of time. Mm-hmm. And I was seeing movies every day. I got a lot of stuff in. And I wanted to go over how that went with Abe and share it. And we can share it with the listeners.
Yes, of course. Yeah. I'm going to be very excited to put on my Q&A hat. You can't see it, listeners, but I'm wearing a hat with press on it.
I kept teasing that I should be wearing a press hat when I went to the film festival, like walk in with the hat and a little slip in the.
Were you going to do the 1950s style accent?
Excuse me,
Mr. Costner.
Well, speaking of, Abe and I are going to talk all about the most of the things that happened at the Santa Barbara Film Festival that I was able to witness. I did get to see the U.S. premiere of Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 2.
That's right.
Yeah, a film that has no release date as of now, and not even a studio, it seems. But not only did I see that, but friend of the show Scott Mendelson drove up to Santa Barbara and also watched it with me. Then afterward, we promptly recorded an episode right outside the theater talking all about Horizon, American Saga, Chapter 2. Mm-hmm. So after Abe and I finish our discussion here, we're going to seamlessly transition over into that conversation, and you'll hear the rest of the episode play out hearing Scott and I discuss Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 2. So stay
tuned.
It
sounds great.
So, yeah, exactly. It actually does sound pretty. So,
not bad for an iPhone recording.
You're not wrong in pointing this out. I should mention this. There were two recordings because it stopped. During one part of it. The first part of the recording sounds a little bit okay. That's only like a couple minutes. Then the rest of the recording, which is like another 35 minutes, sounds great. So keep that in mind. It's going to sound better in a couple minutes after it starts. Right. So just, you'll understand.
Thank you to our producers for doing that.
Yeah, those producers.
All right. You want to get things going here?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Aaron, you spent 6 days over at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival. A little bit of your old stomping grounds, is that right?
That is correct. I went to UC Santa Barbara during my college years.
There you go. Pretty fun to be back there. What were some of the, I guess, what are the number of movies that you saw during your time there?
I saw a total of 12 movies.
12 movies over 6 days, about
13 movies. Yeah.
2.01 a day.
It was about two a day. I had a few screeners, so I was able to watch a couple more after I left the festival. But yeah. Which is still ongoing, by the way. The festival's still we're recording the Thursday before it closes on the Friday.
This is a Valentine's Day episode, pre-Valentine's Day episode.
Exactly. Yeah.
Does the Santa Barbara Film Festival have some sort of programming that it keeps in mind? Like, are they trying to go for like, hey, well, these are like a lot of like really independent Southern California visions, or what is it?
Well, as mentioned, it's the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which means it has a lot of international features along with other domestic releases. Mm-hmm. They pointed this out. I don't know the exact number, but it was several thousand movies they had. There's a lot of movies they're playing.
Full length and shorts?
Full length and shorts.
Yeah.
And they're very proud to note that 52% of the films were directed by women this year.
That's pretty high, actually.
That's really high. Yeah. It's the majority, but it was impressive to hear. I can't say there's a specific theme in mind as far as movies go. Sure. It's a film festival.
I guess, because, you know, sometimes there'll be film festivals locally and they're just like, well, it's just for local artists. You know what I mean?
No, that's fair. And yes, in that regard, no, it's an international film festival. There's a lot of, there's a wide variety of different nations being represented at this film festival. Mm-hmm. In addition to the films being shown, because it's set during award season, they have a lot of free programs and additional programs that highlight some of the Oscar-nominated films. So there was like a screening of The Substance, and Demi Moore was there to do a Q&A. There was a screening of Conclave, and Ray Fiennes had a whole night that I was at that they talked to him about. So there's a lot of that kind of aspect to it as well. A lot of awards, a lot of like nice awards being given out to many of the nominated actors who all like stop by. It helps that Santa Barbara's near Los Angeles, so it's pretty easy for a lot of these stars just, you know, drive up another hour.
Yeah, and I'm sure you guys talked about it during your chat about Horizon, but, you know, notable that Kevin Costner is a Santa Barbara resident.
Yeah, he lives over there, so it was not hard for him to be like, hey, guys, let's
you guys want to see the second part of my movie that I self-funded?
He was happy. He's happy to call Santa Barbara home, and he was very happy to be able to present his movie there. And a number of the stars did come out as well for, like, nothing beyond we just want to support the movie, which was nice. Yeah,
yeah. We talked to Alex Billington not too long ago about Sundance, and just curious, like, what the vibes are at the Santa Barbara Film Festival. Is it like a pretty intimate thing where, like, they'll shut down a few streets, or is it more of just like it's a city and, you know, there's different parts of the city that you can go to for different viewing venues, and then afterward, like, parties are generally in this area?
So downtown Santa Barbara is not huge, but it's a notable little area. And in downtown, there's State Street, which is just like the main street that runs through town.
Okay.
Which you largely walk on. There's some parts you drive on, but it's largely like, it's like the Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica, for anyone that's familiar with that, where it's more of like all these, there's stores on both sides and you kind of walk around and you can do anything you want. I mentioned that because there's multiple theaters along that very long street. One of them is the Arlington Theater, which is like a 100-year-old theater.
Okay.
That I hadn't been to since I saw Kingdom of the Crystal Skull back in 2008.
Wow. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
That's like the last time I went to that theater. So it's like, that was neat to be in there. And it's very like, it has a Spanish Western kind of vibe to it.
Sure.
So like, it's actually pretty cool to see your Horizon in this theater specifically. And it holds like 2,000 people. Like, it's a huge theater.
There you go.
But there's another theater called the Fiesta 5, which is, it's not AMC or Regal. I don't think it's Cinemark either, but it's one of those. It's a brand, but it's like, you know, it has five theaters or whatnot. The film festival has actually bought that theater, and they plan to renovate it, so next year will be even nicer. But they hold a majority of the screenings in that theater.
What's the seating capacity? Do you guesstimate?
It ranges. There's some that are 200, some that are 300.
Okay, so it's like a stand, pretty decent. Like a stand. Yeah. Let's get to the movies here. What were some of the notable? What is a super notable film that you really enjoyed from the Santa Barbara International Film Festival?
So there's a few I want to mention for sure. Mm-hmm. The last one I saw before I left the festival ended up being probably my favorite. There's like two or three that are like my favorite ones.
Okay.
It's splitting hairs between like which one, but the last one I saw was called Trifoli. It's an Italian film. It's about a young woman who's been living in London but was born in Italy, who returns to Italy to see her grandfather, who's like 90 years old, and he's played by this like 90-year-old stage actor who's like been in stage and movies like forever, since the 40s and 50s. Like, he was in like Fellini movies and stuff. He's this old actor now, but she visits their grandfather, who is obviously, he's older, he's a truffle hunter.
He and his
dog go out hunting for truffles and whatnot. They have he has a nice old home, and it's on all this land, and like wineries want to buy it out from under him. And now he's in a position where he hasn't paid his mortgage. So it's like, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So the granddaughter is there. He stubbornly kind of accepts the fact that she's in his life currently. And it turns into a kind of a hunt for her to find a truffle that can maybe save the land.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a fable in that sense, as far as the kind of adventure part that kicks into gear there. This movie's really good. Mm-hmm. It looks fantastic because it's shot in this, you know, little part in Italy, just great scenery and all around and everything. It's well acted. The director co-wrote the film with the woman who's the star of the film. They wrote together. Apparently they made a lot of like short films together, and this is like a bigger venture for them.
Yeah, it looks like they've got like 12 short films that they've done.
Something like that, yeah. And the dog that's like the truffle hunting dog that, you know, sniffs out the truffles, I don't want to like commend a dog too much in acting, but it's a very good dog.
I mean, why not? We commended a cow in First Cow.
That's different, Abe. That was a great fuck. That was a great cow.
Apologies.
That's a great cow.
Beautiful coat on that cow. Yeah.
But the movie, it's very, very good. It's very, you kind of lock into like what it's trying to do early on as far as giving you the scenery and getting you an understanding of like city girl comes into town and you're just, you know, finding your way about things. But then you get more invested emotionally in like what's going on. It makes some choices later in the film that I found to be quite interesting as far as what you're seeing in the kind of in the wilderness versus when modern times kind of catches up with things.
Yeah.
It's quite good. I really enjoyed that one.
Do you know, I guess, what the operating budget was on this?
I have no idea.
Okay, no worries.
It's a small movie. I mean, like nothing that I've seen besides Horizon, obviously, would have cost anything more than like $10 million at most.
Yeah, because you're describing, I guess, scenery and also location and kind of just more for like aspiring filmmakers. Like you could do a lot with a little, you know what I mean? I'm just curious like what they might have had there. Was the director there to present?
Director was there, actually. I think pretty much every movie the filmmaker was there.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Yeah. Q&A session too?
There was a Q&A. Yeah, if the filmmaker's there, there's always a Q&A after the screening. Yeah. So just like with a couple exceptions, yeah, pretty much every screening I saw, there was, the filmmaker was there, which is always nice.
Yeah, it's always great.
We tend to, you get the film festival like worker, they're asking questions, and I'm good with that. Then it gets to, let's throw it out to the audience. And that's what I'm like, let me find the door.
They do that too?
let me find the
door. Do they do that for like one or two questions maximum, or is it actually like...
It's usually one or two maximum, and inevitably, it's always... Because like an older audience tends to be the ones that go to film festivals.
Okay.
And so they always feel like they have to
I should have asked you that in the beginning. Like what's the age demographic that
it was
that
pretty old for the most part, unless it's like friends and family kind of thing where, you know, then you can get kind of younger people in. For the most part, it's older people that go to film
festivals.
But like their questions will always be like padded with a whole lot of compliments and maybe a story that does not relate to anything involving the movie, but they just have to tell it.
Aaron, they need someone to listen to them. They're old.
Well, they have the spotlight, so they really enjoy it. That's for sure.
Final question for Trifoli. Yeah. Between this dog and Anatomy of a Fall dog, Messi, who's the better dog actor?
That's a good question. I do think Messi has more required of him as far as dramatic plot-related elements. So I would give the edge to Messi.
Okay.
But this dog, Birba, I believe, it's a good dog.
Okay, I mean, I'm excited for the dog stuff.
You know me, I don't tend to get hung up around.
Yeah,
I don't tend to get hung up on the animals too much, unless it's like cows and shit like that. You know, if there's like a really plucky giraffe, I'll talk about that immediately. But if it's like a dog or a cat, I'm like, yeah, all right.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
as much as I enjoy the Palm Dog Award, that's very important. I mean.
True. Yeah. What's another movie that you really liked?
Another one I saw, which is also like tied for my favorite, is I Hate Myself and Want to Die.
Okay. Aggressive title.
It's such a title. It's a dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a man who is having a bad go of it. He just like lost a job. He lost his girlfriend. He's like, I'm going to kill myself and I'm going to I'm going to do so by driving out into the desert. It's set in Lancaster, California. I'm going to drive out into the desert.
Well, now I understand.
Well, the movie actually, it uses its landscape for thematic reasons as well, which is actually pretty clever in that matter. But the guy, he drives out to the desert and he's like, I'm going to do carbon monoxide poisoning to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, he realizes, oh, this isn't working. Why? He looks it up. Oh, the catalytic converter makes it very hard to do that these days. I need to find another means of doing that. Okay, I need a hibachi grill. I got to go find a hibachi grill at a hardware store, and I'll use that to kill myself.
Okay.
I'm driving to find this hibachi grill. Oh, my mom's calling. What does she need? Oh, I need to pick up her pills. Okay, let me go pick up my mom, pick up the pills. Oh, my friend's calling. It becomes a whole series of things that delay him from doing the actual suicide.
Uh-huh.
It's a movie set over like one long day. It's very funny. The fact that it's dealing with suicide does make a difference. It's not all fun and games. That does play a role, and there are dramatic beats that I think are quite effective. The star is Mike Castle. He's the main character here. There's another actor named Andre Hyland who plays like his best friend. who's hilarious in this movie. Huh. And he's had like bit parts and things or whatnot before. He was actually, most of the cast was at the screening actually.
Okay.
But just, it had a lot of like, for being a dark comedy about suicide, it had a lot of like good natured humor and banter that like, I think appeals to our kinds of sense of humor, Abe.
Sure.
As far as the kinds of references they're making, which probably just stems from the fact that the writers and directors are around the
are
same
like our age.
Yeah. But I like this one a lot. And everyone, like, whenever I was talking to other people at the festival, they'd be like, what have you seen? What'd you like? And I'd be like, I hate myself and I want to die. And either they had seen it and they also agreed, or they're also like, I keep hearing that that movie's hilarious. So, like, everyone seemed to really like this
movie. Incredible travel word of mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe it debuted at South by last year, so it's still like touring festivals.
Right.
But it was good. I was very happy with this movie.
Is it like a two-hander with Mike and Andre or
no? It's
like a Mike story.
It's more like Mike's story, and then people pop in and out.
I see.
Like,
okay,
you know, like a mom will pop in, a relative, a friend, what have you. So like it's episodic in a sense, but it's still like, you know, there's a pretty clear narrative of what the drive of the film is.
Yeah.
So.
Related to the distribution, are these films kind of just going to be independently distributed somewhere, or are they up for grabs as well from the studios?
Mostly a mix. The international films, it's a bit tricky because some of those, you know, just works differently. Like one, I know like Sony Pictures Classics has it.
Wow.
Another one, has already come out in France. Actually, the opening night film, it came out in France already. And I believe, that's the one Sony Pictures Classic has. Another one that's Peruvian, I believe, is maybe going to be picked up by Sony, something like that. And then the films that are like, you know, American, depends. Some of them are just, some of them debuted for the first time. Some of them have just been touring festivals. So it's a matter of, if they find a distributor, then they find a distributor.
Because you're really selling me on, I hate myself and I want to die. And I don't know if they have a distributor just yet, but I'm just curious to see like what the dialogue is like, especially because you mentioned that the humor is kind of on point.
It's the kind of film where I could see getting... it'll get some level of distribution to the point where it's the kind of film that I'll get a press release for at some point and be like, hey, that's that movie I saw.
Yeah.
And my name might even be in it because I wrote a review.
which
happens every now and then. I'll be like, oh, that's mine.
Yeah. did you also stick around for this Q&A?
I did. And actually I was very friendly with the director.
Jay Davis.
I was in line waiting to get into the movie. The other thing that was cool about the festival, I had a press pass, and the press pass gave me anything. Like if I went anywhere I wanted to go, it was like a skeleton key. Like anything I wanted to do, I could do because I had this press pass.
Yeah.
I was waiting in the fancy line. It was like always both, like a general audience line and a whatever line.
Sure.
I was in the platinum line for everything because I was press.
Wow.
But I was waiting in line, and I was like, I'm here to see I hate myself, I want to die, to like one of the festival people, and a guy next to me is like, oh, you're gonna see that movie? He's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I'm the filmmaker, I'm the director.
Wow.
I'm like, oh, that's nice, how you doing? And we talked for a bit, and I was happy to stick around afterwards and talk to him because I don't want to ask questions of the thing. I'd rather just talk to him close. But he was very friendly. He also edited another film that was at the festival, a documentary that I also quite enjoyed. It was called Space Cowboy. It's about skydiving. It's about the guy who like innovated skydiving cinematography. So whenever you watch Joe Jennings. So whenever you watch movies like Point Break or Charlie's Angels, movies that have skydiving sequences in them, he's probably the guy that filmed those sequences.
Got it.
And he was there.
Great. Yeah.
It was a surprise that he was there. Like we didn't know. We knew the directors were there. One of the directors who did Sunshine Superman, which, you know, another like aerial sports documentary. But it was solid. It's a solid look at what that life is, and mixing footage of both, like, you know, crazy aerial stunts, and this guy Joe Jennings kind of reflecting on, he's in his like late 50s, probably, or, you know, probably at this point, kind of reflecting on his life and people he's lost because, this is, you know, it can be a dangerous sport.
Right.
And just giving us kind of a neat narrative through line about kind of what he wants to accomplish doing this still and frequently.
Sure. So. Well, very cool. And I'm glad that, Jay Davis has been around for a couple films at that same festival. So probably had to do like a ton of coverage there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you said a few. Was there another one that you really liked?
Yeah, there's two more I want to talk about for sure. We can see where we are. One is called The Knife. This one has it was vague on who's distributing it, but it has distribution. It'll come out in the fall sometime. It's directed by former NFL star Nnamdi Asamugha,
Asamoah.
Asamoah?
Demondi Asamoah.
Demondi Asamoah?
Yeah, Asamoah.
Yeah, Asamoah. That's what I said the first time.
Okay. You know who his wife is?
Yeah, Kerry Washington.
Yep. Yeah, there you go.
Washington.
No, say it again. No.
he's been in a couple things I've seen him in at this point, but this is his directorial debut,
right?
As well as his act, as well as he's starring in it. This is probably the most frustrating film I saw because, and I mean that in a good way, because it's just what the story is, but it's about this guy, Asamoah, who he's father, husband, he has a home in an okay neighborhood, he has two daughters and his wife. It's late at night. He's put the daughters to bed. He's going to sleep with the wife. Hears a noise in the kitchen. Goes to the kitchen. Random old white lady's in the kitchen. Why?
Oh, no.
She's probably on drugs or something.
Uh-huh.
Something happens. We don't see. Come back. Woman's on the ground. There's a knife next to her. She's probably dying. We got to call the cops. Somebody broke into our house. So what do we do? Now, with calling the cops means, well, we're a black family that has to call the cops because there's a white lady on the ground that's dying. That means we can't just call them and say what happened. We need to prepare for what this could actually lead to.
Right.
And the whole film is about this long night dealing with how this situation plays out. Melissa Leo plays a detective who arrives that kind of investigates.
Oh, Melissa Leo's in the movie.
Leo's in the movie. She plays a detective who's investigating, trying to find out what exactly went down. And it really, like, as an audience, we know that this family did nothing wrong, except not even except. It's just self-defense. It's a situation that turned dire, and now we just have to see it. But the movie's very aware that it has to play with the dynamics of what it's like for this kind of family to have to deal with police officers investigating a very specific kind of situation. So in that way, it's very tense. When it comes to movies like this, the outcomes aren't often very positive. So it certainly builds up to certain avenues that will be frustrating to watch play out.
Right. But
it's well acted. It's well shot. It's well just overall just really well made. I was a fan of this film. I was annoyed as I could be seeing how things played out in it. But it's quite good. I enjoy it.
Yeah, I often am kind of conflicted by those films, too. I mean, a whole entire TV series, The Night Of, is all about stuff like this. But then also there was that Amazon Prime movie that you and I talked about during the pandemic, where it's like the college student who helps like that white girl out. And then like things go awry, and then a really satisfying ending.
Is it
where she comes
emergency?
To apologize.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think it might have been called that, where
with,
he's
with Sabrina Carpenter.
Was it Sabrina Carpenter in that movie? Wow.
She's the sister of the woman they're helping.
That's probably right then. But yeah, that's another example of a movie where it's like, this is just frustrating because this is it's clearly not what happened.
It is called it's called Emergency, yeah.
There you go. The Knife, co-written by Mark Duplass.
Was there
a lot of like mumblecore style?
It feels very tightly scripted in what they're doing. That's why it has distribution. It's a Duplass production, so it has some backing already going for it.
There you go.
And it's in touring, I think, festivals as well, because there's a few interviews I saw online with them talking about the movie.
Yeah.
But it's worthwhile for sure.
Great. Okay. Well, I'm glad it has distribution. Also, like, you know, Asamoah is a Cal guy. So there you go.
Is that where he went?
He went to Cal, and then he played football for like 7 years.
That's why you're aware of so right.
No, I mean, he's also a Raider. Were there other, there's another movie, right?
There's one more. Yeah. I want to talk about O Horizon.
Okay.
This film is, so it stars Maria Bakalova, David Strathairn, Adam Pally. It's directed by Madeline Rotzler, whose real name is Madeline Sackler. She's part of the Sackler family. Mm-hmm. And from all I could tell, based on everything I looked into following this and learning this information, seems like she's very disconnected from the things that the other Sacklers dealt with as far as Purdue Pharma and all that. That's neither here nor there. But it was just stuff I learned as I was learning about the movie. Regardless, this film is about a neurologist, a young neurologist played by Maria Bakalova from Borat 2. She just lost her father. She's grieving due to that. Her father's David Strathairn. Mm-hmm. And she finds it's set like in the not too distant future. And think of like Her, where like Her's kind of future, but like not quite.
Right.
It's in that kind of realm. And she finds this business that has this technology. It's run by Adam Pally's character, where you can take all your texts and pictures, video, whatever, of anybody, and it'll sort that and turn it into basically a brain of that person. So doing that, she decides she can recreate her father and try to find closure with him.
Interesting.
It's like an app. She'll call the app and she'll just be having conversations that are all rooted in this technology kind of recreating the father.
Yep.
So it's a film that's about both the grieving process as well as kind of debating the function of AI.
Sure.
It's a film that also utilized AI in its production. There's the neurologist based work that she's doing. They're trying to like map the brain of like a monkey so they can do other tests. And like, but like in doing that for the movie, they used AI to create the kind of visualization of what that looks like.
Okay.
An
actual AI model.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so like it's interesting in that it's using AI as a tool, which I can accept, and it's certainly like it's like doing it in a willingful way where it wants to figure out what kind of limits and things. It's not doing it as a way to like as a crutch, essentially, is what I'm trying to say. It's using it because it's deliberately trying to aid the story that it's trying to tell.
Right. As sort of like an ethical dilemma.
In a moral dilemma, like this, it's calling into question like what function this has, and also utilizing it for the production of the film, because let's embrace this and see what we can come out of it. So it's like it doesn't necessarily like change my whatever perception I have of AI, but it's certainly like it's trying to bring it into a different kind of conversation as opposed to just the standard ones of is this good or bad that we can do like, you know, X number of other things.
Right.
Instead, this is something more intimate and interesting, which I think kind of stems from the fact that it's a female filmmaker doing it.
Yeah.
Where you look at,
this is the film that you were teasing when we were talking about Companion last week.
Yes. Yeah. You look at what male filmmakers have done with AI, and it's like, you know, they generally do result in things that are something like a Companion or Terminator or things where the world ends.
Right.
And you look at a female filmmaker that's writing a film, and it's like, I just want to like deal with grief and like things that are like small scale and emotional and intimate.
Okay.
Which I know it's not limited to out of many genders, but it is interesting to look at just some, you know, just
kind of like
one side of something versus another. Yeah.
Yeah. Did they arrive at the reasoning for the title of the movie in the movie?
Yes. There's a very specific reason for it. Like, Oh Horizon does refer to like the top layer of like soil and dirt, but like there's thematically it connects, and there's, it gets very specific. It comes with the film as far as where it goes. But it's very good. I want to emphasize that. Yeah. I really like this movie. Baklova, I've only seen like do kind of ensemble-y stuff for things, you know, obviously she's with Sacha Baron Cohen with the Borat movie, but also like there's like Bodies, Bodies, Bodies and whatnot. But like this is the first like, so it's the first like lead performance I've seen her have. And she's very good here. I was impressed by her performance. And that's before I'd met her. And she's also very nice.
Oh, you met her too. Great.
So yeah. So this is the one film I had like I got invited to like a big reception for afterwards. Yeah. So like the director was there and she was there and Adam Pally was there and Maggie Grace from Lost, who's in the movie, was also there. So like that was like fun and whatnot. But in terms of like just the movie, she's very good. It's like a comedy and it's a drama mostly. It has comedy in it. I wouldn't say it's like a comedy drama. It's just more like a drama that has hints of humor in it.
Right.
Just like it has kind of elements of sci-fi, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a sci-fi. It's not like Ex Machina. It's, you know, it's a little, it's more subtle in that way.
Right.
But David
Schwimmer. Another example of a male doing sci-fi for Ex Machina, where again, it's like
how far
he's just making him dance. I'm glad that you had a good time with O Horizon. Did you know if this one has distribution?
It doesn't as of yet. This was the premiere of the movie. This was like the first time anybody's seen the movie. So I imagine
the SBIFF exclusive there.
Yeah. I imagine it'll have like, you know, it would be touring festivals, but it's the kind of movie that it because of the stars involved and because of the, but it's like, it's probably the outside of Horizon, probably the most expensive movie I saw.
Yeah.
It'll find its way, I'm sure. On a bigger scale than some of these other ones.
Yeah.
Probably will.
Were moving off of the movies that you really enjoyed, were there any movies that you can think of that were good effort and you're like, it just didn't get it for you?
There is nothing I actively disliked. I know what you're asking. Like, I was just trying to narrow it down. Like, there's nothing I actively disliked. Yeah. There's nothing I was like hesitant on. Mm-hmm. There's a couple that I'm like, these feel like indie movies that you would see at a film festival. And I don't necessarily mean that as like a pejorative, but it's just more of a, it's not offering all that much that's new. It's just giving me like another example of this kind of story I've seen.
Yeah, yeah.
One is, so without getting too far into it, one's called Spider and Jesse, which has McKenna Grace, which is why I watched it, because I'm like, okay, she's gonna like be like in a drama. Let's an indie drama. Let's see how this goes. And it's fine. It's her. She has a younger sister. Their mother's died from like a drug overdose, and so their solution is, we want to hide the body. So foster care doesn't like separate us.
Yeah.
So it's like it's like a coming of age thing with like a bit of tension in that respect, as far as like people are gonna obviously start asking like, where's the mom? What happened to her? And it's mostly fine, especially when it deals with the sisters. It's more when like plot drama needs to happen. So like the mother has like a bad boyfriend and he like keeps coming around and he's very over the top evil in a way where I'm like, all right, this is just the movie needs to happen as opposed to something more organic. So it's like, it's okay. It's nothing special. She's good in it as far as like giving her more cred beyond stuff. Ghostbusters and playing the younger version of blonde actresses in Flashback.
She and Kiernan Shipka both.
The other one I saw that was kind of like, it's fine. It's called Lucky Star.
Okay.
It's a Canadian film with an all Asian cast.
Interesting.
It's basically Kin's Convenience, except a different kind of thing.
It's about that?
No. It's about this guy who goes by Lucky, who used to be a gambler, and he has a wife and two daughters, and he like fixes iPhones for a living. Mm-hmm. He gets phone scammed, basically.
Okay.
A scam gets him, takes a lot of his money, and now he's like, now I'm down $10,000.
Whoa.
And I need to get this back immediately, or like, you know, I can't function.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, I got to go do gambling. It's my only solution, which is obviously he's an addict. So it's like, that's bad. And so it becomes like this thing about him basically sneaking in and gambling, and the wife's, is she going to figure it out? Are the kids going to figure it out? What's it going to lead to? And I mentioned Kids Convenience. Kimchi's actually in the movie. He's a co-star of the movie. In a serious role, too. He's not funny. Uh-huh. he's playing like his best friend who's like, dude, you can't gamble. Like, that's not going to help you. But it's fine. Like,
it's like a good effort.
Yeah. It's a good effort. I know I know what the beats are of this thing already.
Yeah. When you're describing the plot and kind of the action piece that happens, I can kind of, I've seen movies like that too. But again, everything is kind of derived from a lot of things. Kind of depends on whether the director wants to take it a step further, I guess.
I will say the film gets points for like when you're seeing the gambling, it's not about like the cards. We're not like watching the poker being like, oh, is he going to get the flush? Like that's a kind of afterthought. It's like you see more of the results than you actually see the actual gambling take place, which I enjoyed because I didn't like, we don't need to add to this with like poker stakes. Like we could just get either he wins or he loses and we have to go from there.
So it's more about like the personal drama.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Was there anything that really caught your attention in a genre that you weren't expecting? So did you see any documentaries where you're like, this is, wow, I'm kind of impressed by this, or even like an international film, like not English language, that were like, wow, I'm really impressed by this?
Yeah, the opening night film, the documentaries, I only saw Space Cowboy, which I liked, and I didn't get to enough docs, mainly because I only had so much time to see stuff. So like, just to give you a point of view, I was working like my regular job during the festival, so I could only see two movies a day. Like, if I wasn't,
you and I have regular jobs. We put out like 14 podcasts a week.
The podcast money mountain that we used to have is really it's really gone down.
That Audible cash.
It's really.
I think we made like $24 over that.
We've really diminished the funds. Really diminished the funds in our podcast mountain. Money bin is closed for the time being, so we have to work for a living.
If you want to send us some money, we'll give you our Venmos.
But But yeah, so like if I was just straight up taking, you know, time off work, I would have seen like more film today, and I probably would have fit in more documentaries. The thing is with documentaries, I could generally find them. Like they tend to have like they tend to be around. I can usually get links for them or whatnot. And I do have a few that I'd like be happy to watch at some point. I just haven't had a chance to yet. But I did see the opening night film as far as one that kind of stuck out to me. Opening night films at film festivals usually want to be like a crowd pleaser because you want to get things off on the right foot. It can't always be like the biggest thing you have, but it can be something that's like agreeable. So the film I watched was called Jane Austen Wrecked My Life. It's a French film. It's already, like I said, it's already got Sony Picture Classics behind it. It's already out in France or whatever. And it's like French English. It's French, like the main character is all French, but it takes place largely in England.
Okay.
And it's about this woman who, she's a writer. She works at a bookstore. She's got low self-esteem. She's going nowhere. One of her friends sends in some of her writing to a writer's retreat, a writer's like residency. And she gets accepted, and she's like, all right, I guess I'll go to London and go to this writer's retreat. She's a huge Jane Austen fan. The retreat that she's at, one of the owner's sons is a relative of Jane Austen, like, you know, down the line. And it becomes a sort of like romantic comedy that approximates what a Jane Austen plot could be in like a similar type of Jane Austen story in modern times.
Sure.
And it's good. Like, I enjoyed this bit. Like, it's the kind of thing where if you're gonna like pay homage to Jane Austen, that could be a tough ask if you're not doing it so if it's gonna be a romantic comedy that wants to do that kind of thing, that's not necessarily something I'm gonna flock to immediately,
right?
Because I just feel like that's tricky to do, and it really has to be really good for me to like want to accept that as more than just kind of fluff.
Yeah,
but no, this was nice. It was a nice. It is very funny for one thing. I was laughing a lot during this movie, which I'm happy. You know, in a comedy, I'm happy to laugh in a comedy. But it's like it's well, shines in this nice little part of London, or not London, but England, where like just a big mansion that has all this nice real estate to look at and everything. I like the leads, the woman and the two men that she's kind of like intertwined with. One guy's like clearly like, you know, 20, 25. Lil Rent Hugh Grant kind of role, essentially. Like, he's good at it.
But I wasn't sure where you're going with this, but I was like, oh, okay, I get it.
Like, he's good in the, it's just more, you get what kind of character he's trying to play.
Yeah,
he's playing a Hugh Grant type in a Jane Austen movie.
Yeah, yeah. He owns a bookshop. Got it.
It's the kind of thing where this opening night films, while I say they tend to be crowd pleasing, that also means they tend to be. That can be slight and can be often bad, or at least lesser than other movies I saw. But I was actually happy that this is one of the better opening night films I've seen at a film festival. So.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that it also got picked up by Sony Pictures Classics, which is a pretty serious distributor.
Yeah.
And that means that they got some high hopes for it, I guess, come next or this coming in
sometime. Yeah.
Fall 2025 award season.
We'll see.
As far as like the SBIFF goes, where did you stay? Kind of like, where were the vibes? Like, did you have like, was it bustling every night? And did you go to sleep like pretty exhausted?
These are all good questions. I stayed in an Airbnb.
Okay.
I was in a walkable distance to all the theaters.
Yeah.
Oh, with one exception, but that's because it's up in the hills and it's purposely away from everything. But
right.
I drove up there. I stayed in the Airbnb. Very nice.
Awesome.
Washington. It's a very nice place. I'll be happy to stay there again next year.
There you go.
It was raining for half the time I was there.
Yeah.
So that certainly like led, you know, there was less going on as far as, you know, the bustling is concerned.
Yeah. That's about it.
I only had there's like a cocktail hour every night as far as the festival is concerned.
Yeah.
So like there's places to be, and there's like restaurants all along State Street again, so you can go anywhere to eat and everything. Yeah. And I certainly ate my dinners and whatnot. But in terms of my interaction, like I only really did the reception on that Saturday night for O Horizon, but every other night it's like, I saw two movies. I got to go back to the place and write. I got to get stuff done.
Yeah.
So it's like, I had a good time at the festival, but I was always busy. Like I was never not occupied doing something, but in a good way. Like I haven't had to do that in a while. Like see multiple films in like a day and then cover them immediately right after.
Exactly.
So it's like, that's a fun, for me, that's personally just a fun challenge to have to kind of get a lot of work out in a short span of time, which I did, and I'm very proud of it. It's all on Wheel of Entertainment.
There you go.
But yeah, no, it was, you know, the vibe wise, like, it was a friendly environment. So I was happy to talk to a lot of people, as I generally do anyway, when I go to see movies. But people were like pretty happy to be there. The volunteer staff was very nice. You know, like, people, I like when people know what their duty is at these kind of things, and like know where to tell you to go or whatnot, and don't give you attitude about it.
We'll talk offline about your other experiences then.
You know, it's just sometimes you get volunteers that they feel like they're in a position of power, and so they have a certain way about themselves as far as how they conduct.
I'm talking about the LA County ones. Got it.
Well,
yes, got it.
So it seemed like everyone
were in Santa Barbara.
For here, it seemed like everyone was pretty cool with like just wanting to be like, yeah, go this way or go that way, or I can tell you who to, you know, that kind of thing. So it was nice.
Yeah.
I enjoyed my time very much there.
I'm glad. It looks like they give out a lot of celebrity tribute awards. Were you there for any of them?
Yes, I was. Every night they do some kind of like award thing.
Every night.
Except because they have like craft awards, they have acting awards, they have like all the nominated directors were there the night, like the night after I left. Timothy Chalamet had a whole night devoted to him.
Was he there?
Yeah. Everybody was there.
Chalamet just everywhere right now.
Everybody nominated for a major award was at this thing.
Fantastic. Okay.
And so I was there for Ralph Fiennes night.
Yeah.
It wasn't called Ralph Fiennes night, but he was there. He was receiving an acting award.
Yeah.
For Conclave. But the whole thing was like 2 hours devoted to a one-on-one interview between him and the Hollywood Reporter's Scott Feinberg.
Okay.
Who they just sat down on in front of the stage at the Arlington Theater. And they just went over his entire filmography.
Wow. 2 hours. What a treat.
It was. And Ralph Fiennes, a guy, you know, he's a proper British actor.
Yeah.
You would, like, if you were to make an assumption about him, it could be, you know, that he's going to be a little, you know, stiff because he's Ralph Fiennes.
What?
Not the case, sir. Ralph Fiennes is a delight. He has stories. He's animated. He's happy to talk about his career. It was great. And it was great that, like, obviously you get the, you know, you get the Schindler's List, you get the English Patient, you get the obvious ones that are up there, and for good reason, you know, there's good movies and good
all the Bond stuff,
all the Bond stuff, but and Harry Potter, of course,
but
you got the small ones too. Like, I was like, Strange Days getting some love, In Bruges, movie Sunshine, that's really good with
Cillian Murphy one,
yeah, the other Sunshine,
yeah,
You know, just movies that it's nice to see get recognition, like, as far as his career goes, because he's had a long and wide ranging career.
That's right.
It was really cool to just sit there and just watch Ralph Fiennes talk about his life for 2 hours.
I'm glad. Yeah.
And then Edward Berger, the director of Conclave, showed up to hand him his award. It was
really unannounced.
Cool. I don't know if he knew that was happening, but I didn't know that was happening.
And right.
That's fun. Like, he came out.
Yeah.
Give him an award.
It's very fun. It looks like he won the Outstanding Performer of the Year award.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what it's called.
I saw a few clips circulating around, I guess, the gentleman from the Hollywood Reporter asking about Rafe versus Ralph. And, you know, he seemed like he was game for discussing, like, yeah, of course it's spelled Ralph, but, you know.
That's how they kick things
off. I'm in England.
They kick things off of a discussion of why his name's pronounced that way. And yes, it amounts to basically, that's just how it is in England. And how it used to be in general. And then it changed.
Well, I'm glad that you had a good time. And you did you rub elbows with any celebs? And you're like, hey, you know, it's really cool to see you. And you are shorter than I expected.
Well, I never have to tell them they're shorter than expected because they're always shorter than expected. That's how it is.
Hey, Sam Levine is a great guy.
He fits in your pocket. The only one was the O Horizon reception, because I met I met the whole cast of that, except for Strathairn was busy doing, you know, Strathairn things.
Godzilla 72 or something.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's what he's. And you know, I would have been excited to talk all about just Godzilla with David.
100%.
I was dressed up because it's a reception. I was wearing my nice jacket that had a big Godzilla pin on and everything. Yeah. I was like, I was so prepared for that conversation. But no, I just had to slub it with Adam Pally instead and have a good time with him, who is.
Yeah, great. Steph Curry's friend, Adam Pally.
Steph Curry's best friend, Adam Pally. I should have brought up that show. I almost did.
That's very cool, though. I'm glad that you had a good time. Is it one of those things where you would go back?
I can't wait to go back. I look forward to going, like, now that I'm I know what I, it's not like I didn't pack enough stuff. Like I had too much stuff, if anything, but like now I know like what I need exactly, especially if I'm going to stay for the whole time next year.
Which would be about 2 weeks.
Yeah. It's a bit, from a Tuesday to a Friday to the following Friday. Yeah, so yeah,
that is like quite a long time.
So I know exactly what I could do to like kind of perfect what I've already like worked already. So
yeah.
Yeah, no, I would be happy to go back and happy to stay in the same place, I'll be honestly. Like, of course, as soon as I learn the dates, I should probably reserve the time so I have a place again.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I'm not talking about, obviously, is Horizon, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah.
But that was certainly a nice event as well. We don't really talk about the event that much, but yeah, Costner was there. Happy to. He and the costume designer and then the composer, John Debney, they all stayed after the movie ended to do a Q&A as well.
Right.
Which was, you know, nice to hear and everything.
Did they I guess that they were there for basically like 3 hours then.
It's a 3 hour and 10 minute, it's 10 minutes longer than the last one.
Holy cow.
We were there the whole 2,000 people there for 3 hours and then another like 45 minutes because we're doing a Q&A afterwards. It was a long evening. And fantastic. Then Scott and I are like, let's do a podcast. So there's another 40 minutes there.
Finding that energy. Well, I'm glad they had a really good time at your old stomping grounds in Santa Barbara, but also at the SBIFF. And it sounds like it's a great time. I know that people can get tickets if they wanted to online. You can get tickets for kind of different numbers of movie packages, but also kind of just one for the entirety of the thing. And I know that you're there from like a press standpoint. So I'm glad that it went well. And you are not one that is shy about film festivals. You've been to many of them in Southern California. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that this is kind of making its way onto your list of like, maybe it's an annual event.
Yeah. I certainly had no regrets about embracing this one. And it is a pretty, I like how easy, you know, it's not LA, so it's pretty easy going. So it's like, you just have to get up to Santa Barbara. But if you have any interest,
beach
like,
vibes.
It's pretty, and once the rain stopped, by the way, which it did, it was, it was lovely outside. It was really nice, which is Santa, it makes sense. Santa Barbara, it's a nice beach community.
Yeah, exactly. So, next time, maybe Kevin Costner will invite you back to his bodega or something like that.
If I wrote a positive review for chapter two.
Yeah.
So maybe, get
he's going to read it and be like, now that we're best friends. And then he's going to listen to our old shows and be like, wait a minute.
Hold on. What are all these terrible things you said about me?
Yeah. Of course, I didn't want Henry Cavill to save me. It's a movie. Well, Aaron, that was a great chat. I think we'll just kick it right over to you and Scott chatting.
Yeah, let's move on to our review of Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 2.
Okay. I am here now with Scott Mendelson.
Wait, what? How did I get this car? Help! Help!
We have just emerged from the Arlington Theater in Santa Barbara, part of the Santa Barbara International Film Festival.
What the hell happened?
I've dragged you here. We have just come from the U.S. premiere of Kevin Costner's Horizon, An American Dawn Saga. Thank you.
Chapter two.
The second chapter of the promised four-chapter saga, the Western epic that'll total 18 hours?
Oh, no, 3 times 4 is 12.
12 out? Okay. Well, he keeps saying how many, there seems like there's more.
I mean, to be fair, unless part 3 is like 6 hours long.
They also have, I mean, this one was 10 minutes longer than the last one.
It really was.
So exponentially, this might grow. But, we've just seen Horizon Chapter 2, a film that still has no sign of a release date. Curiously, there was no Warner Brothers logo on this screening either. So even if it comes out of the... I don't even know if it's going to be like a Max release anymore.
I think that die has been cast.
I'm very curious about all of that, but we don't have the answer to that as of yet. But we do have the exclusive as far as our thoughts on Horizon Chapter 2. So Scott, before you get into chapter, just give a brief summation of what you thought of chapter 1, then tell me what you thought of chapter 2.
I liked it. I thought it was a solid 3-star piece of old school Hollywood entertainment. I thought it was most interesting as sort of a meta commentary, both on the pop culture and general cultural impact of Dances with Wolves, which while Business with Wolves was not obviously not the first film to retell American history while openly acknowledging the sins of the past, it was a film that sort of kickstarted the modern apologeta, deconstruction, self-critical era of historical biopics and historical movies. Again, wasn't the first, but you know the other ones didn't make $425 million and win a shit ton of Oscars. So, you know, I think he's very aware of that legacy and the fact that the movie inspired Avatar, which, you know, by default, by being a film that made, you know, the two Avatar films made almost $5 billion. So in terms of the privileged white guy is tasked with wiping out indigenous people and realizes, maybe I shouldn't do that, that franchise certainly has the biggest pop culture footprint of any of the post-Dances with Wolves pictures. You know, again, I don't think it's a coincidence that he cast Sam Worthington in a major role in the first film. I know that it's a coincidence that Giovanni Ribisi keeps popping up in what seems to be a major role the next time. Slight spoilers, he shows up like at the very last moment of the first film.
That's okay, yeah, go.
And he shows up briefly in this picture as well.
He bookends this one. So there's a little more Ribisi to earn the third billing, I believe, he has in this movie.
He's basically Michael Massey from the Amazing Spider-Man films, where he would pop up at the end credit sequences to tease a interconnected Sinister Six that would never happen.
I was told the Amazing Spider-Man films were constantly teasing an entire universe throughout the entire movie and not just in the final minutes. But
yeah, that was marketing kind of fucking up, but that's an old discourse. So yeah, I liked it. I thought what was interesting about the first picture is that the first hour is, I would argue, one pretty straightforward storyline dealing with, you know, a group of settlers that get attacked by Native Americans and have to resettle after that and cope with their losses. And, you know, Costner doesn't even show up for like the first hour of the first movie. And it isn't until the second 2 hours of this first film that you get sort of the give and take. You know, we jump into Costner's mostly standalone adventure story. And then we get into a group of people that are traveling, you know, on a wagon trail to settle in Horizon, which is, you know, the great valley of this franchise. And this film is a bit more conventional in the sense that it hops around from one story to the other at a much quicker pace.
Well, okay, so real quick on my thoughts on part one. I'm less enamored with it than you are. I think it's ambitious, and I think it aims for something that is obviously not going to be completed until, you know, three movies later. But as much as I like some of the performances, obviously the filmmaking or what have you, I did find issues with the editing of the movie. I do think its pacing is not the strongest, especially because, yes, there is a whole hour devoted to a certain aspect of the story for the most part, and then it kind of jumps around in a way that doesn't feel super organic. It feels like, oh yeah, we gotta like introduce this, that, what have you. And I accept what the plan is here, but it did feel like it was kind of just coming together in a way that I wasn't agreeing with. Not because it like didn't wrap up itself or whatnot, because I expect it not to. It's part one of four, but it did seem like to struggle with how to open this thing that's going to expand wider on. That said, it did leave me wanting to see like where this was going. I really like the next time on the horizon montage that we have at the end of the first movie.
I mean, and Doc is trapped in the Old West. And holy shit! How is Marty going to get his time machine back there?
And I'm glad we get another end of montage in this movie as well. But okay, so chapter two. What did you think of chapter two?
Well, chapter two opens with the Fellowship has been disbanded. Gandalf is dead. The two hobbits that aren't Sam and Frodo have been captured by the Orichai, so they're fucked. And
the Nebuchadnezzar's been destroyed. Morpheus doesn't know what he's going to do.
I mean, but everything has a beginning that has an end. Everything that has a beginning has an end. So, you know, this is neither the beginning nor the end. So, you know, by default, it's going to be a less self-contained movie than the first one, which I thought was at least as much of a standalone movie as something like Fellowship of the Ring or what have you. Thirdly, I thought it was more standalone than any number of part ones of the post-Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Twilight, YA fantasy franchise stuff, but I digress. I like this one less, partially because part of what I enjoyed very much about the first film was the discourse and the conversation between Sam Worthington's disillusioned soldier and his superior, played by Danny Houston, who was a little bit more on board, but he certainly wasn't some kind of manifest destiny lunatic or anything. And because Sam Worthington is barely in this picture, that's not a spoiler. Very slight spoilers. He goes to join the Union Civil War very early on.
In New Zealand, where he has to fight against the other Na'vi. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And after he's attacked early in the first act, he gets scared. He takes his family and he joins the Water Tribe. Was not expecting that. So some of the stuff that I liked about the first film just isn't there this time. And okay, fine, whatever. I do think this film is more conventional in the sense that its multiple storylines hop back and forth a lot more frequently. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that I think Kevin Costner has slightly more screen time this time around, but I felt his presence in the film was far less organic. He felt more like for lack of a better term, sticking out like a sore thumb. And maybe that was because his presence in the first film was mostly confined to one, frankly, very suspenseful and tense subplot. Mm-hmm. There's a sequence with him conversing with somebody as they walk up a hill where he knows that he knows that he knows that there's danger, and it's probably one of my favorite scenes of the first picture. Mm-hmm. This doesn't have a lot of that. It has less action, frankly, for what that's worth, but it also has less genre elements that provide tension and suspense and anything beyond conventional Western drama.
Okay. I like this more than the first one. Much like I like Two Towers more than I like Fellowship of the Ring, I guess.
It's my least favorite of the three. They're all very good.
I think the film's a lot more settled in terms of how it's managing these storylines. Because it has the introductions out of the way, it doesn't really have to do anything to jump us into this in a way that I found problematic in the first film. If anything, the different storylines and the editing between them, it did feel more organic to me, including the Costner stuff. I do think it doesn't feel like, for me, it didn't feel like it came out of nowhere. It felt like, I'm aware that this is one of the main storylines. We need to deal with this. Mm. How are we going to deal with this? Well, yes, there's maybe more time with them overall, but yeah, it's less impactful in terms of thrills per se. It's more of build up, which feels more like a classic Western. If you take his storyline and separate it out to what it is, you can flesh that out and make that its own little movie.
Yeah,
like a guy that's kind of on the run, has a shady past, don't know what he's up to. He's working this thing. There's other guys in town. They're assholes. Like, there's a plot there that I've seen in other Westerns before. I do think there's like three storylines, right? There's the wagon train. There's Sienna Miller's in the frontier,
yes,
and Costner, right? Those are like the three. Which? And then there's kind of another with the bad family that's on that's looking for Costner.
They're also barely in at this time.
They are. Okay. There's because we already kind of have. If there's not going to be a resolution to the story, there's no reason to keep showing them.
Yeah.
Right. So there's like a mini plot involving them because there's another woman that's also on the run. Also, that was with Costner with Abby Lee, I believe.
Yes.
But I liked how it was. It felt like it was. I don't want to say snappier, but it just felt like the editing seemed stronger this time around. Like because he filmed one and two pretty much back to back, I believe. I think he had more time to work on two as far as getting a handle on what the pacing was going to be like for a movie that's 3 hours and not super fast paced. If it trades in action for what I found to be just genuinely good character work, I'm not mad at that. The film keeps promising there's going to be more action in the following chapter, so I assume 4 is going to be the Deathly Hallows Part 2 of the series. It's just nothing but action sequences.
I want to see people turning into werewolves and holes being punched in the ground, heads being ripped off.
Just all the deleted stuff from Gore Verbinski's original Lone Ranger.
Yes.
But no, I did like this move, this entry more. I felt invested in all of these characters. Partially because, yes, I know them already, but because I genuinely like the work they were doing here, I will, if I have flaws, which I have, I don't think this is by any means a perfect movie, but if I have issues, it comes from the fact that it is a movie that feels like it's on a budget. Now, Westerns are notably inexpensive. That's why there's so many of them. It's not a, it's a cheap genre, but it's like horror. You can make things on the, but for doing such an epic thing, it's irritating for me to be like, I know there's $100 million here or whatever, six, whatever they want to call it.
and the, you know, it looks very good, but while the cast members are mostly very good, a lot of them, like the first one, feel like they're TV actors. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that as a detriment to the actors, but when you have, like, such rich production value, and then you have somebody that looks like they're from the CW, it does kind of stand out, where you're like, I see Costner, I see Zeta Miller, I see Luke Wilson, I see people that, like, have been on the screen a lot, and they kind of have a certain kind of presence. Then I see, like, the guy that Costner works for, and I'm like,
yeah,
this just feels like a guy that was on, like, some show in a bit part once. Like, there's not... That's not me trying to be unfair to those actors. It's just more like there's a lack of authority that I think should come with some of these roles because the film is made at a certain budget level. So you can only afford so many things. That's also why the film seems to take place. While it's expansive, there are a lot of we're in this place, we're in this place, we're in that place. There's not a lot of travel.
I will say I agree with you. I was more aware of the nuts and bolts of the filmmaking, which is something to me that, you know, okay, I can tell the but, you know, that's when you can see the budget that I was in the first film.
That is, I would say the first film has a strength by being more of a travelogue than by comparison. And it has things like, because it has action, because it has a whole like elaborate Native American versus people versus the frontier,
which is a spectacular action sequence.
It has more, it's more dynamic in that sense.
I will say that I and again, I didn't love the first one. I don't hate this one. I think they're both solid. I will, if he ever finishes, gets to finish part three, I will be there with bells on. I do think this one was more, it almost felt half resettling and half Wagon Trail. And I found the Wagon Trail stuff far more compelling this time around than the Sienna Miller stuff. Partly because the more interesting characters from that subplot weren't there this time. And that one felt far more like table setting in a way that it didn't last time, where I felt the real interesting in-the-moment storytelling and character work was in the Wagon Trail sequences.
Yeah.
And that's neither here nor there. It's just, you know.
I can say, like, I would agree, and largely because, I mean, you're the one person that's like, there wasn't enough Sam Worthington in a movie. I don't mind him. I think he's entirely fine.
Yeah.
But I will say the Wagon Train stuff, which I did find really compelling in the first movie by the time it happened, mainly because it was the most propulsive of the stories, because it has it has a known goal.
Yeah.
Where the other ones don't really. They're just like people that are around in an area, and you're like, where is this going exactly? This time around, that's another reason I like this movie more. I think because each of the different plot lines have a goal in mind. I know Costa's trying to do a certain thing. I know Sienna Miller's trying to do a certain thing. I know the Wagon Train's obvious. It's the Wagon Train. It's going in a direction.
Yeah.
The Wagon Train stuff, I think what annoyed me, I guess, was that as much as I like the Wagon Train stuff, it feels like it was purposely made to be the darkest version of that story.
Oh, God, yes.
Given the events that take place in it. So you're, like, frustrated watching, I guess, Wagon Train politics to run their course in a manner that's obviously not very fun, for lack of a better word, because of how certain characters are affected, especially the way in which they are infected, and the fact that you're sitting there being frustrated as an audience member thinking, there are solutions to this, I feel, and yet they're not being taken.
Yes.
Now, part of that comes with the fact that, as Kevin Costner on stage explained to us, that's how the world works sometimes. At the same time, I'm also thinking, surely this is a matter that could be solved if one character just explained out loud what's happening to somebody else.
Yes.
and there'd be more than just a, well, reckon we can't do much for you, man. You got to take it for yourself. And like, really? That's the only solve here? Like, there's a key moment where a character is basically going to do harm to themselves because they don't have a solution. And then when someone asks, why are they doing this? They avoid every single detail that would explain why they are doing this that would be helpful to them.
They answer very cryptically.
And it's like, we need more here. So, like, at the same time, yes, it takes up so much of the storyline that there's a certain crowd-pleasing element by the time it gets resolved in a way.
Even though I felt that was almost too crowd-pleasing.
Yes, that's the problem when it's something that's so frustrating because of the many different routes you can take to solve this.
It gives credit where credit is not due.
Mm-hmm.
Although, to be fair, without going into details, I do think certain characters that are exalted in that moment are brought low later, if that makes sense.
No, that's fair.
So I don't think it's as, you know, perhaps it's not as simple-minded as I thought I was perhaps reacting to the lazy crowd, you know, the lazy applause of the crowd.
That's, yeah, that's not unfair. And I will say, yes, there's a method to what's taking place. And I think a lot of that does also come down to the research being done and just general human nature, like what's realistic versus what's cinematic.
Yeah.
And if this movie is trying to prove certain points about how to ground this in a reality that might not fit the format of a regular Western, but does fit in the reality of what human beings can behave like, I can go along with that.
Yeah. And so far, I mean, both films are, without being oppressively mired in doom and gloom and darkness, and they're both very cynical, pessimistic pictures in the sense that they deal with the subject matter in a very matter-of-fact, you know, shit happens, deal with it kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
That goes both to the white people being, you know, attacked and, frankly, the Native Americans being exploited, threatened, and or doing the attacking.
It did seem notable that there's less Native American related stuff in this film, and that the drama that falls out and even some of the action that falls out is directly related to just essentially white man being bad to white man.
Yes. And frankly, I mean, you know, just the first film, most of the interesting Native American subject stuff is, or subject matter is just in the first hour of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
After the first hour of the movie, that stuff almost disappears. With a couple of, you know, one interesting exception late, you know, early in the third act, but I digress.
The Jeff Fahey stuff in the
bar, yes.
In the bar, yeah.
Which, again, is another terrifically suspenseful sequence.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's another thing that first film does have. It does have more suspense, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think this film is more, obviously, because it's a chapter two, it's like a branch. You know, it's a build-up to other things that are going to happen. But I would still say this feels like a succinct movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
In the midst of being a, you know, part of a larger story, I do, and it felt less jarring, I guess, when it ended. Where I do think the first one, I was almost laughing at how weird it felt that just like kind
it's
of abrupt,
pretty abrupt. It
abruptly turns into a montage of what's going to happen next time,
like,
on Horizon.
I didn't realize I was watching the montage till about 25 seconds into the montage.
Yeah, it was weird that way. This one feels like it has kind of a natural opening and ending, mainly because of that dastardly Ribisi.
I mean, he's eventually going to unite that Sinister Six. Damn it.
Mm-hmm. he's the scorpion.
And also, of course, you know, we've seen the first movie, so we know that's the game that it plays. And also, it's the second of four. I don't expect it to be any more self-contained than, to use the obvious example, The Two Towers is less self-contained than Fellowship of the Ring. That's fine. I expect that going in, mm-hmm. because it's neither the beginning nor the end. And do I think the film could be, you know, again, is there a world where this can be maybe three-hour films, or maybe four, two-and-a-half, two-hour movies? Maybe, but whatever. The movies are the movies.
Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, the issues I have aren't related to, like, the nature of what the project is. I'm generally excited about, like, what he's doing here.
The first one was never going to make money, because that's just the world we live in. I mean, Open Range was 22 years ago, and that barely cracked 65 worldwide, and that's one of the best Westerns of the last 30 years.
Yeah.
This is not. But I still really appreciated the idea of, hey, let's, you know, I guess at least two of four, and let's put release one and then release the next one in a month. That was the idea for Fear Street back before Sherman sold it to Netflix amid the pandemic. They were, you know, summer 2020, you're going to have 1996, 1978, and then, you know, 1666. Mm. It was going to be one a month, and that was going to be the trilogy.
Yeah,
and I like that kind of thinking outside the box.
Yeah, I'm the kind of idiot that would have easily gone to the theater every Friday to see those movies in that manner.
Absolutely.
To narrow things down to some of the performances a bit, because we got more of some people and less of other people, we got a lot more Will Patton this time around in his gorgeous blonde hair that he had, which I think he wore a hat the whole time last time. He's not in it that much. So
it seems to balance out Kevin Costner's just awful, awful hairdo. Which, good for him for not being glamorous, but...
Oh, boy. Kevin Costner's... We'll get back to Will Patton in a second. Kevin Costner's choices in this movie, as far as his look goes... Like, I appreciate that he stands out, I guess, but I was already I really hate his hat. I think his hat is terrible. It is among the worst cowboy hats a lead character's ever had. that's not, like, purposely comedic. So, like, this time he's introduced getting a haircut, and his haircut's nonsense. He's got, like, this weird bowl cut, and I'm like, remember Sin City 2, where Josh Brolin, like, he has to get his, like, facial reconstruction so he can, like, fool people?
Yes.
And when they show it, it's just like Josh Brolin with a bad nose.
Yeah.
Like, that was the choice. Now, in the comics, it's, he turns into Clive Owen, which makes sense. And I was really hoping in that movie Clive Owen would show up and be like, that's cool, they did that. This is like that. It's like, he got a haircut and he looks just like Kevin Costner with a bad bowl cut. Like, that's the choice here. And I'm like, put the hat on, please. That was my thought at that point. But, oh, man, I've been teasing the idea that because the montage in the first film showed a lot of Costner not wearing a hat, that I thought the arc was going to be him getting a better hat. That's apparently that's not what we're doing so far. Although the montage of this movie, he's also not wearing a hat or he takes off the hat at one point.
It's weird because, and this is not a spoiler, but, like, there's a major moment in the third act, and the film signals that shit's about to go down because he left his hat.
He left his hat behind. He didn't want to get that ruined. In the scuffle.
Yes.
But yeah, okay, so other actors here. So Will Patton's got a lot more screen time here.
He's fine. Not his best work, but
he's doing Will Patton.
Yeah.
Let's see. Luke Wilson has a little less to do this time around because it's more about Ella Hunt, who gets a lot of time to work on what she's doing here.
I mean, it's almost her movie for the middle.
Her and Sienna Miller basically are the main characters of this movie.
I mean, if I want to be simplistic, this is the chapter that deals with, boy, women had it shitty in the Wild West.
Uh-huh.
And I say that as a compliment.
I not that I'm hoping there's less of them in the next movies, but I do hope that we're done with the amount of hardship they're facing if we're based on this movie.
And, you know, that's not a novel concept. Again, they've been making Westerns like that at least for 30 years, give or take. Mm-hmm. But it's still solid stuff.
Who else stuck out?
Sorry, what was that?
Who else stuck out?
I
mean, the guys playing, like, the worst people, they do a good job playing terrible people.
Yes, yes.
That's the heck goes with.
Honestly, I think that was sort of the issue, is, like, who else really did stick out? Because, again, the ones that stuck a lot, some of the ones that stuck out in the first film are either barely in this or just take a step back. And you're right, it really is the Ella Hunt, who I've liked since In an Apocalypse, and the,
Sienna Miller.
Sienna Miller, sorry. Who is very good.
And Orphan, what's her name? Orphan.
Yes.
The actress who played Orphan.
Who has what seems to be a brief flirtation with a young Native American boy that keeps threatening to turn into Romeo and Juliet. I don't know if that's going to go that path or not. We'll see.
I believe it's a Mexican man, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
Yes.
I thought that was the whole point, is that he belonged to the tribe that killed their family.
He's not a white man, I think, is the point.
Oh.
Because he's working on the ranch or whatever, in the house.
I thought the idea was that, okay, just a dialogue he has right when you first meet him made me think that, like, he was related to the people that massacred her family in the first film.
I don't know why they'd be in that. Okay, regardless. Yeah. The girl who plays Orphan, whose name I cannot remember right now. is it Danielle something? That's going to bug me. And she's very good in that rowing movie that we watched. But she gets a good amount of stuff to do as well. The daughter, they're there. They play Will Patton's daughters. There are more interactions between certain kids.
Wait! I apologize. Which daughter are we talking about?
The rebellious older daughter.
Oh, I thought the younger blonde daughter from Sienna Miller's kid.
Oh, no, strike up
what seems to be a Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, no, that's way different. Yes, okay.
He is Native American, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Obviously, yes. That's...
You almost got me canceled. Fuck.
No, I was talking about Orphan.
Yeah. Oh, you meant the Isabella Furman from Orphan.
Isabella Furman,
yes,
thank you.
Does strike up a relationship with someone on the farm who is indeed Mexican.
Yes.
And
Isabella Danielle, where is he getting that from?
Not Danielle Harris.
Yeah. Isabella Furman, thank you. Orphan. I was referring to the movie, the movies, the Paramount's Orphan franchise.
Yes.
Sorry, Warner Brothers slash Paramount's Orphan franchise.
She might still be making when she's like 45, which good on her if she can get away with that.
Yes. No, she has, and yes, both of the daughter characters have a lot more to do in this film. But no, I think
they both have potentially forbidden romances.
But Isabella Furman, yeah, she gets a good chunk of stuff to do in this movie that I think makes a difference. And she
becomes a surprisingly complex character in a way that I was not expecting.
Exactly. Yeah, I would agree.
Her last scene is kind of great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other daughter, I mean, she's basically there to represent, I mean, not to be a dick about it, but, you know, untouched, you know, purity, blah, 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 whatever creepiness you want to throw into that. It's not as creepy as the first film where she gets hit on by a soldier who looks like 30 years older than her.
Yeah.
But I digress.
Yeah, well, those Union soldiers. what else? Anything else about this movie?
I am looking forward to part 3.
I am too.
It did not come up in the Q&A, but I am curious how much of part 3 he's actually shot. Because the sizzle reel seemed to be very focused on just a few sequences that basically involved almost none of the cast that we've seen in the first two films.
A
lot less than I was expecting.
I would argue that this film narrows down certain storylines, so that frankly might just not be too much other things to kind of cut away to.
Yeah.
Or at least in a montage, there's only so much you can really show that's not just characters talking in a room.
Yeah.
You have to, in a montage, you're showing, like, action and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, and it might just be a more self-contained, this one's more about Kevin Costner than the other two, while they're off on their, you know, whatever.
And yeah.
Everyone else, you know, we're basically table setting for the finale.
Like, if you're showing a montage of, like, Empire, you're probably going to show a lot of Dagobah. Like, there's not a lot there to be like, look at this, you know, there's a puppet. Like, you're going to show Cloud City and the Hoth and whatnot. You're not gonna show some of the major stuff. There are some actors that are going to show up in part 3, too, that I'm excited about, based on what I saw there, too, which I was like, oh, cool, okay.
Giovanni's coming,
and he's bringing a whole gang with him. And, I mean, I don't know what else to say technically, but, like, the movie still, like, outside of budget-related concerns, it's shot nice. It looks good. There's a scale to it that I admire as far as they're in locations.
Yes.
And John Debney's score, I do think, is pretty good.
Yeah. And recognizable themes that I always appreciate.
Has stuff going on. So
the dance number at the end was sort of weird, but whatever. You know, it's, come on. Shrek's almost 25 years old. It's time to stop doing that.
Danny Houston has a lot of rhythm, though. So we have no idea when this movie's coming out. Now, so far, it's screened at what? I believe Venice last year.
So.
And now it's had its U.S. premiere here. You know, I don't know what to take away from that, which is a weird place to be in a movie like this that costs this amount of money.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's going to play, it has to drop somewhere.
Yeah, someone has to say...
Like, it's complete. It's a complete film.
That's sort of the challenge of something like this, that unless the story is finished, and whether that means all four films, or it means he, you know, retrofits part 3 to make it a finale, like they did with the Fantastic Beasts franchise, where, you know, the core dilemma is solved, we'll let somebody else deal with Grindelwald and we're going to go off and collect beasts, then the two films as they exist aren't worth much. Like, there's not a ton of value of watching, you know, it's like, I you know, how many people rewatch the Divergent films knowing that, you know, third one ends on a cliffhanger?
Do you think there are Divergent parties? Like, people watch all three and, like, play act what they think the fourth one would be?
My wife and daughter are currently watching the series because they got into The Maze Runner and they liked The Maze Runner. And they asked for the other ones. I said, you know, it's not good, but Divergent. And
did they watch Beautiful Creatures, a film that we love?
They're waiting for me to be home for that one.
Okay, good. All right.
Yes, that was the first one I mentioned. I was like, no, wait for me. I want to watch that one, too, because that one fucking rocks.
Good, okay.
But I have not told them that it ends, part 3 ends on a cliffhanger with no part 4. And I don't know if they remember the cost, you know, when I brought this up, when it happened, you know, nine years ago.
So the last thing they see is what, Naomi Watts, like, shoots Kate Winslet in the head?
No, that's the end of part 2.
That's the end of part 2, okay.
Part 3 is just like, Jeff Daniels is there. Why? Da-da-da-da.
So this movie has presumably no distributor right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
That was a really curious thing that Warner Brothers is just not anywhere involved in this thing at this point. Now, the film is premiering. Costner, I presumably, owns it.
Yes.
So I assume he's just shopping it around, and we just haven't heard any kind of announcement as of yet.
Yeah, and again,
what's the most likely thing? Like, it gets like a... Like a Fathom event release just for like the sake of announcing it that leads to a streaming drop.
Yeah, assuming that I don't know how done part three is. I think a lot of that because again, if like your Netflix or your Hulu or Amazon Prime or whatever, I mean, again, unless there's another one that finishes the story or another two that finish the story, there's not a ton of value in just buying this one. And I think that's part of the problem that he's had.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, again, he was making this movie for a while, and I was always of the opinion that he sort of knew what he was getting into.
Sure.
That surely he's a smart guy, and he's seen what the theatrical industry looks like now versus 20 years ago. And... you know, again, after the film came out, it was like, oh, you know, maybe, you know, he's in more money trouble than we think, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I don't know how much of that is true. It's gossip, but it's like, did he really think that this was going to be some kind of, you know, big hit where it like maybe all three films make, I don't know, $200 million worldwide total, which isn't enough to cover, but at least puts you on a path to where long-term these projects have value?
I don't want to get too speculative, but I do wonder if maybe Warner Brothers convinced him that could be.
I mean,
it's like, look, don't worry, Kevin. Like, whatever we don't make in the theater, we'll make back in, you know, in digital and physical and whatnot. And then by the time part two comes out, people will be caught up. And then they just didn't, they maybe overestimated their expectations for what this kind of ambitious project would do. Yeah. It's not necessarily the worst thing, but it certainly might have set expectations higher than everybody expected.
To be fair, without nickel and diming here, I mean, I never thought it was going to be a hit, but I thought at worst it would do $50 million worldwide, and that would be not great, but then the next one would do 50 worldwide, and then they, you know, maybe each do 25 and post theatrical, which again, the studio gets more of than theaters do, because it's, you know, 80 versus 50. So, you know, but you know, the first one, just nobody showed up.
Now,
and
presuming that these each, I believe they're each 100, like 60 to 100, somewhere like that, would that make this essentially like one of the biggest independent movie projects of all time?
Not since the, since the Star Wars prequels.
Right?
Because they got three movies for around 120 a pop. And so again,
What did part one make again? What did that make worldwide?
Oh, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I think it was like close to $30 million, $40 million.
It's not high. It wasn't even 50.
If you stall for time, I can look it up.
It's okay. I assumed it was under 50, but okay.
I mean, it's the everything about this project is in limbo because everything about this project is in limbo. And surely, if Netflix theoretically comes on board, it's going to be, okay, we'll take the second film, we'll give you money to finish the third, and either you wrap it up in three or fuck it, we're Netflix, nothing matters. Here's money to do the fourth one. And they get to at least whatever the huzzas there are from being the one that came in and saved Costner's project.
I'd imagine the difficulty now is the fact that the first chapter's still on Max.
Yes.
And so Netflix can't just like port something over right away. So they have to like wait a certain time period before they can actually get the rights to begin with. And then they would put
the irony, of course, is that it's on Netflix right now. It's one of many Warner Brothers has a window with Netflix after Max, and I think it's after Max, just after Max.
Yeah.
And you know, and you have people that don't know anybody. It's like, oh, it was number one on Netflix for like an hour. That must mean it's profitable, and people really want it. It's like, that's not how this works. I mean, for those who don't understand, every remotely theatrical movie that drops on Netflix is momentarily popular because that, you know, most streaming platforms subsist on theatrical movies. Mm-hmm. Things that people either didn't get around to seeing in theaters or stuff that they saw years ago and liked and don't mind rewatching. So, again, the fact that it was hot on Netflix for an hour doesn't mean anything, for better or worse. So I don't know what's going to happen to this film or the next one or the next one.
Okay. So in terms of exclusive news regarding Horizon sequels and this movie, nothing to offer. However, we have seen, thanks to the 40th Santa Barbara International Film Festival, we've seen Horizon Chapter 2, I liked it a little more than the first. Scott liked it a little less than the first, but we'd still say worth seeing.
Absolutely.
And when people can go do that, no idea.
When would you suggest seeing Horizon Chapter 2 in American Saga, Aaron? In IMAX? In theaters? Or
I'd certainly say see it in theaters, if that's ever at all possible. But certainly give it a rent on VOD, whatever that date becomes available. But yeah, it's such a curious position to have this in. And it was a big premiere. Costner was here, a lot of the cast, John Debney and the costume designer were on for a Q&A. Like, they screened part one before this, so people were already...
Did they?
Yeah, they screened, a free screening of part one first, then they did this.
Which, by the way, this expects that you've seen part one.
And then, yes.
There's no recap.
There's no previously on, as much as I would have liked
previously on Horizon, Saga.
I think you pick up, I mean, I don't think you'd be really lost.
No.
You're walking into
No, I'll be honest, I did casually rewatch the first one a couple days ago, just while I was doing other stuff.
Uh-huh.
Just, I'm glad I did, because there was stuff that, not that I'd forgotten, but you know what it is when you don't watch a movie for, you're like, oh, yeah.
And on Friday, they had their debut, Kyle Costner's debuting a documentary, on Saturday, there's a documentary that's coming out.
Early. Oh!
So there's more to this. So
does he, like, have a heart attack in the jungle? Does Marlon Brando take over the film with Val Kilmer and League?
They had a whole different idea for how the West looked, and then they're like, this isn't Mario at all, and then they did a whole different thing. we've seen Chapter 2. We have thoughts. You've heard them. I hope this was helpful for anyone.
Jim Carrey just loses his fucking mind.
I hope this was a helpful way to soothe anyone over as they await the upcoming, pending, whenever release of Horizon
and American Saga. And for those of you listening that are just been lying with bated breath to see Horizon Chapter 2, I just want to say, ha-ha, we've seen it, and you haven't, and you may never get to see it, but we saw it, and you didn't. Ha-ha-ha-ha.
Yes, we presumably might be some of the very few that have seen it in a theater. That's for sure. Scott, where can we find more of you online?
If he lets me out of this car, I'm on Buck News on a semi-regular basis, more or less every week, give or take, but I write, run, and maintain the Outside Scoop at Substack. That is basically daily Mendelsohn's memos, for lack of a better term. Okay. I do a podcast once a week called the Box Office Podcast, which is me and other younger, cooler, more culturally relevant box office pundits who talk about what happened that weekend.
You can find everything I do at thecodezeek.substack.com. All my work ends up over there. I'm covering the entire Santa Barbara Film Festival over at We Live Entertainment. All that I'm covering can be found there. This podcast, we've anywhere you can find podcasts. You know where you can find this show. All the socials and all that. Tune in and enjoy. Scott, thank you very much for talking with me about Horizon American Saga Chapter 2.
Can I go home now?
I'll let you out when I feel like letting you out. But that's going to do it for this bonus, this exclusive bonus episode about Out There Today. So until next time, so long and goodbye.